you can see, we have a huge turnout tonight. And we've also had enormous excitement leading up to this talk, with audience members being very active online to help guide the direction of the interview tonight. So Ajahn Brahm, this turnout tonight is a tribute to your life's work, which has been to inspire, brighten and enlighten the lives of, I think, millions of people around the world. From prisoners to saints, you have helped people unconditionally and with an open heart. And tonight I hope you can share some of your secrets to success with us all. So the plan tonight is that I will ask questions for about the first hour. And these questions are largely inspired by the audience's submission. So it's through my voice, but I hope it really reflects the interests of everybody here tonight. And then for about the last 25 minutes or so, we'll open it up to the floor so that the audience can ask questions in their own voice. And then just at the very end, we've got a few announcements about our society and some exciting Buddhist events coming up. And just a reminder, Harry mentioned that there's a form coming around. Only fill out the form if you're a Melbourne Uni student. Put your student number. That means we get funded for the night, so to cover the cost of hiring a hall. So if you're not a student, don't sign up. It doesn't even matter. But that, all the formalities aside, so thank you, Ajahn, so much for being here. And my first question for you is, as a young man, you grew up in a working class household, and then you were lucky enough to get a scholarship to go to Cambridge to study theoretical physics.
Hard work.
Where did Buddhism fit into all this?
Hard work. Where Buddhism fit into this was very simple and absolutely true. I realized as a young man that spirituality or religion, whatever you wish to call it, is important in life. It's a very great assistance in many of the difficult problems of life, but also gives you an overview of the path of your life. So I knew spirituality was important, but why should you just follow the spirituality of your parents, of your country or your culture, when so many other things were on offer? So I managed to get a school prize, my first school prize. And instead of getting books on maths, I was about 15 or 16 at the time, I got books on all the different religions. Because I wanted to find out what all the different religions were teaching so I could make my choice. It's what we call these days market research. And it makes a lot of sense. Just because there's many Indonesian Buddhists here, Sri Lankan Buddhists here, Thai Buddhists, but just because that you are born into a culture, why do you have to follow that particular religion? You have the freedom of choice these days. Article 18 of the UN, United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, UNDHR, the freedom of choice of a religion or no religion. So it's wonderful that we have the ability to do that. And when I do go to places like Indonesia, as many Indonesians here, many Muslims come to my talks. They're Buddhists. Why not? We have the choice. So I took my choice by research, first of all, find out the type of spirituality which fat my worldview, fat my understanding of science, and fat my understanding of life. And that's why I chose Buddhism. Oh, like one of the things was, you know, obviously it was compatible with what I was learning in Cambridge in theoretical physics. Just even recently, the very first Buddhist I ever met, when I did go to Cambridge University, just up, probably like here, there's many clubs and societies which you can join. And when there was a big exhibition of all the clubs and societies, I was so pleased to see the Buddhist Society at Cambridge University. And I was so excited, I went to the counter and said, I want to join. And the man who was at the counter, the student, said, no, you don't have to join, just come and see first of all. And I said, no, I'm already a Buddhist, I want to join. He said, no, come to a couple of talks if you like it. And I said, I want to join, join me. And he became a very, very good friend, Professor Bernard Carr. He was a student of Professor Stephen Hawking's and a very close friend of mine, a Buddhist and a theoretical physicist. And also, just like me, interested in psychic stuff as well. We would spend time as students going hunting ghosts. It was really good fun hunting ghosts.
Are you serious?
No, serious, yes.
Hunting ghosts?
Hunting ghosts. It was England. There were so many ghosts in England. Look, there was this one story I'll share with you. This really is an Australian lady. She was visiting England, and she was touring one of these old English castles, really spooky, with narrow corridors, all stone and cold, and every sound of your feet just vibrates, it seems, with the whole castle. And it was really, really, really spooky. Not the headless ghost, no, but at the end of the tour, she asked the guy who was taking her around, "Are there any ghosts in this castle?" And the guy said, "No, since I've lived here, I've never seen a ghost." He said, "How long have you lived here?" And he said, 300 years. He was a ghost, yes.
He is a ghost.
Yeah.
Hey, that doesn't sound very scientific.
No, that was a joke.
He's already a ghost.
So I'm wondering about your early experiences of meditation. I know a lot of people in the audience, when we sit down as humble beginners, sit down to meditate, it can feel very frustrating. So I'm wondering if you found that, or did you have a natural affinity here?
I think I had maybe a natural affinity and some good teachings from the very beginning. In other words, somebody taught me how to meditate without using so much effort. Look, you guys and girls, you work so hard, you know, in your student career, in your work career, in life. And then when you try and meditate, it's just another task to do, another job, like washing the dishes to complete, or cooking, or mowing the grass, another thing to do. And meditation is totally different to those things. I say, like meditation, you have your computer, and meditation is a default position when you're not clicking the mouse, when you're not doing anything. And then the screen goes to the screensaver, like the breath. That's the screensaver. And then it stays long enough, and even the breath vanishes. The computer turns off. Now that is really profound. Wow. Cessation, emptiness, stopping. That is awesome, yeah. So this is a different way of meditating, which is so easy because it's only difficult when you want to achieve something. If you've got nothing to achieve, why are you struggling? So if you just want to be, instead of trying to get somewhere, then you understand what meditation is. I travel around many places in the world. Today, I arrived in Melbourne. I still haven't seen many human beings in Melbourne. I've seen many human goings, many human doings, but very few human beings being here. If you understand that, you understand how to meditate. Why is it so hard? Because you're just so brainwashed and conditioned to achieve something in life. I was told when I was a kid, the devil makes work for idle hands. And what a lot of bullshit that was. You know, he's made much more, you know, there is a devil, much more work when people have been doing stuff than when you've just been sitting still, being quiet. It was Louis Pascal, the great French mathematician, who said, all the problems of, he called it mankind, this is in the 17th century, all the problems of mankind come from not knowing how to sit still. That's amazing, just what a prescient piece of philosophy that was. Learning how to be quiet and be still, to be. That's what meditation is really supposed to be driving at, just being. Not trying to get something or go something or change something. Look, there's an old, okay, I'm going on my stories now. A very key story, one of the my students over in Western Australia, known him since he was, you know, the size of these kids, coming to the temple, looking after him, doing ceremonies when he graduated from high school, goes to university, goes to med school, becomes a doctor. First year as a doctor, he came to see me, really traumatized, and he said, I have to change my career. After all that hard work of becoming a doctor, he said, I cannot do this anymore. Because what had happened, he had been looking after one young lady, 23, 24 years of age, who was his patient, and she died unexpectedly. And he felt, number one, guilty, that maybe, you know, he could have done something and kept her alive, but also, he was the one who had to go to her husband and say, your young wife, only married a few years, the one that you've invested all your dreams in, is dead. And your two children have got no more mother. She's dead. And that was just almost impossible for him to do. It was such a pain inside. He said, I can't ever do this again. And I feel so bad about this. And that's when I told him a little thing which you can expand to all areas of your life. I said, you've misunderstood the purpose of being a doctor. The purpose of being a doctor is not to cure your patients or cure the diseases or fix up their wounds. That's not your main job. If you think that's your purpose, you will fail many times in your life, in your career. So the main purpose of a doctor, or even a psychologist, psychiatrist, anyone in those caring professions, the main job is to care for the patient. Curing is number two, but caring is the priority. And if you realize your purpose, your main job is to care for the people under you, you never need to fail. You can always succeed. They may die, but they die being cared for. And they know they're being cared for, and the family knows they're being cared for. And that takes away a lot of the sting of death. And also, I said, you'll probably find that if you prioritize caring above curing, you'll probably find that more people will recover than will die. He got it straight away. He went back to work. Now he's a specialist. And he always reminds me, he came and saw me a few months ago, always reminds me of that story. He said just how helpful it has been and how he spread that to his students as well. That's in life, even in meditation. You're not trying to cure yourself of all your bad habits, of all your restlessness, of all your craziness. Don't try and cure yourself. Care for yourself. If you cure yourself, you get frustrated. You'll be a failure. If you care for yourself, you can always do that. There you can always succeed. So the meditation should not be about curing something. It should be about caring.
A lot of people, I think, in healthcare professions, and also women in particular, I think can care too much. And they just give and give and give until they reach burnout. And you care too much.
Absolutely no, you can't care too much. But the care has to be focused. Here's a nut. Can I tell stories because they're really... Okay, they take up time, but they're very, very good. This is a story which has to involve you. Some of you may have heard this before because there's going to be a question at the end of this little story. And I want to find out what you think the answer is. But if you've heard it before, I want you to keep quiet. So it's a story of the seven monks. A long time ago, seven monks were meditating in a cave deep in the jungle on kindness. And a band of thieves found that cave in the middle of the jungle, realized it would be a wonderful hideout for them. So after they've stolen or even killed, it's a place they can go until the police has lost them. They can hide there until the heat goes down. And it's also a place where they can store all the stolen goods. There's only one problem. The monks were there first. So the head of the thieves decided to kill all the monks, the seven monks. Now the seven monks were as follows. Listen carefully because I'm going to ask you a question about this. The seven monks were the head monk. The second monk was his brother. The third was his best friend. The fourth was his enemy. Even though they were monks, they had personality clash. The fifth monk was a very old monk. He was so advanced in years, he could die any day. The next monk was a very ill monk, and he was so sick that no one knew who would die first, the old monk or the sick monk. They were both close to death. I don't know what's funny about that, but I'll take a laugh anywhere I can get it. And the last monk was what we call the useless monk. I think he could be a candidate. Anyway, the head monk, he was such a good talker. He could be a used car salesman. He could even be a politician. He could even be the Prime Minister of Australia. He could sell anything to anybody. But he convinced these thieves, because what they wanted to do, they wanted to make sure that these monks would not tell the authorities the location of the cave. And even though the monks said, we won't tell the authorities, just let us go free, the thieves had to show that they were serious. They wanted an example. One monk would have to be killed in front of all the others as a warning that the same would happen to them if they told the authorities where the cave was. And that's the best the head monk could do. So the head monk had to make this terrible, terrible choice. Who had to die so everyone else could be free? So, if you were the head monk, who would you choose? Before you make your decision, I'll go through the list again. The seven monks. Number one was the head monk. Number two was his brother, who would do anything for him. That's what brothers do. We can sacrifice ourselves for our family. Same with the best friend. If you have a really, really good friend, they will do anything for you as well. And number four was the enemy. He never really liked him anyway. Life would be much more peaceful without him. But then you got the next two monks, the old monk and the sick monk. They were about to die. So what's the matter? Just a few more days. And the last monk, the useless monk, who'd never done anything for anyone in his whole life, is one chance to make some good karma. So, those were the seven monks. If you were the head monk, who would you choose? Now, if you heard it before, be quiet.
Okay.
Yeah, who would you choose?
Himself.
Himself. How many agree with the young man in front? He would sacrifice himself. Very good. You are all wrong. And that is the most common answer. And the reason I tell this story is to get that answer up and to show you that was wrong. Any other suggestions? Yes? The useless monk. No. Even though you're useless, you're important. I'll save time. The answer is there was no way that head monk could choose because his love towards his brother was exactly the same, no more, no less, than his love towards his best friend. And he loved his enemy exactly the same, no more, no less. He maybe not liked him, but loved him. And he loved the old monk and the sick monk and the useless monk no more, no less than anyone else. And most importantly, He loved himself no more, no less than all the other monks. His love and respect was so equal that there was no way he could choose. And I remember just about 15 months ago in Sacramento, telling that story to an Episcopalian bishop. And he also said, as Christians would do, oh, he sacrificed himself. And I couldn't resist out-Christianizing the bishop when I said to him, don't you remember your Bible, bishop, where it says you should love your neighbor as yourself? It does not say to love yourself less than your neighbor or more than your neighbor, as your neighbor. To love your neighbor as yourself means to love yourself as your neighbor, no more, no less. Which is why that monk could not discriminate between any of those monks. He loved everyone equally. And that's the answer to the question. Yes, we care, we love, and there's no limit to how much love. But it also goes to us as much as everybody else. We are in the equation. We are in the balance. And if you understand that, you understand, yes, we should love, but we should love the right things. And the right things is the other story on this. Part of my job is to do marriage blessings. And one of the little tricks which I always do, I always look at the bride first of all, and I say, from now on, you're a married woman, you must never from today on think of yourself. And she always nods and smiles sweetly. Then I look at the guy, the Australian, and I say, you are now a married man, from today on, you must not think of yourself. And he always pauses first. He does. But eventually he comes. I said, okay, yeah, fair enough, okay. And still looking at the guy, I say to him, and from this moment on, you're a married man, you must never think of her, your wife. And then looking at the wife, I say, and you must not think of your husband from now on. And it's a wonderful moment when you can read their minds without needing any psychic powers. They're thinking, what is this crazy monk on about? And that's when I tell them the solution. He said, from today on, you must never think of yourself, nor must you think of your partner. From today on, you're married, you must only think of us. Not me, not him, not her, but us. So love and kindness, there's no limit to it. You can love as much as you like. More the better, but have the wisdom that that love doesn't go just to others, it goes to us. You're included, so am I. If you do that, marriage is so easy. I know, I've been a monk for over 40 years.
But the monks in the cave, so they couldn't choose.
Yeah, so what happened? This is based on a story in the Buddhist texts, the story of Thalaputta. It's in the Theragata. It's been changed considerably by me. But the essence is there that the thieves were so impressed, as I hope you are by this, they were so impressed that half of those thieves asked to become monks. And the other half, they went back to the village and got proper jobs. Now honestly, you may laugh at that, but sometimes when you're inspired and see the world, see life in a different way, it's amazing how that can change your life, even like lifestyles, and see things in a totally different way. Because a lot of time people who do get into crime, you know, they haven't had inspiration in their life ever. Nothing to really uplift them, only things to bring them down and down and down to a lower and lower level every time. But to get inspiration and good examples, that has a huge effect on changing people's lives.
What if somebody's made a big mistake in their life and they feel very guilty and they feel like they don't deserve their own love because
Excellent.
They've made a genuine mistake?
Yes. How many people have made big mistakes in their life? I will tell you one of my recent mistakes. One of my recent mistakes. It was a Chinese Buddhist. They were really, really sick, so they invited me to the ICU in Royal Perth Hospital in West Australia to do some chanting. You know, for their father was really, really sick. And so I went into the ICU, and he was dying. He was on his last few breaths. But I'm a powerful monk, and I really gave some really strong chanting, full blast, superpower. And it worked. He actually recovered and got better. And that was my big mistake. The family were really angry at me. They said, Ajahn Brahm, we asked you to come in here to chant so he could have a peaceful death. Not so he could recover. We'd all come from overseas, ready for the funeral. We'd arranged everything with the funeral directors. And now you've messed it all up. And we're going to have to do this all over again in 6 months or a year's time. And I said, it's your fault. You should have told me what type of chanting to do. The die peacefully chanting, which is one type of chanting, or the get better chanting, which is totally different. So now, whenever I'm invited to do any chanting for someone, especially when they're sick in hospital, I always ask, what chanting do you want? Get rid of them chanting? Or get better chanting? So when I make a mistake like that, what do? I learn from it. And I also laugh at myself. And I share all my mistakes to other people. Because when you tell your mistakes to other people, it means you're human. You're not some person who landed from Mars. That you are a human being. We all make mistakes. And the thing with mistakes is, it is from mistakes that we grow, that we learn. And the most important thing is to never be afraid of mistakes. So if someone does make a mistake, please congratulate them for it. Well done, you're human, you made a mistake. Nothing wrong with that. Now learn from it. So we don't stigmatize failure. There is no such thing as failure. Failure is just more opportunities to learn and grow, to make more out of our life. But our culture is a culture of guilt, where if we do make a mistake, we expect to be punished. One of the things which I loved about Buddhism when I read my first books, there was no concept of punishment or guilt in Buddhism. And I looked and looked, and this is weird. And I realized that it was instead, and you can all understand this in Melbourne, it was the AFL code. Acknowledge whatever you've done wrong, forgive, no punishment, and learn. That's called growth. That's spiritual growth. Acknowledge, forgive, learn. And it doesn't matter what you've done. So for forgiveness to happen, first of all, it's monks like me and others, you have to help here, have to change our culture to say there's nothing wrong with making mistakes. We all make mistakes, and sometimes they're big mistakes. That, first of all, we have to acknowledge and be truthful. Imagine what would happen if everybody wasn't afraid of acknowledging their mistakes. If Mr. Shorten and what's the other one called? I forget now. I'm a monk. It's really good. I don't know politics too much. The two people who are running for being Prime Minister of this country. If Turnbull, Mr. Turnbull and Mr. Shorten would actually go in front of cameras, I was wrong there. I made a mistake. Imagine just what they would change politics when they would admit they were wrong. It's okay to say they made a mistake. That they're human just like the rest of us. and would mean they wouldn't hide their mistakes anymore. And they would have a culture where it's all right to make mistakes, and we don't punish mistakes, we learn from them, we grow from them. And which means we don't hide them. Punishment only serves to hide the truth because we're afraid of admitting it. And it gives this guilt thing as well. So, always, always, always forgiveness. Always. How many times can you forgive someone? Always one more time. It's a beautiful saying, always one more time. And if you don't agree upon that, look, many, many experiences I've seen where people have forgiven, people have really hurt them. And it's the most beautiful thing to see. There was the Nelson Mandela, Desmond Tutu's Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa. If you want to know about forgiveness, read some of the transcripts there, where there was terrible, terrible crimes which were done. And the perpetrators would confess what they'd done in front of the family of the victim. There's one which I remember reading. A South African police officer was admitting with huge amounts of shaking, trauma, crying, one of the hardest things he'd ever done, in front of this man's widow and family, his kids, describing how he tortured him sadistically and then murdered him extrajudicially just because he was a member of the African National Congress fighting for some equal rights for his community. And at the end of his deposition, the widow, who has just heard for the first time what happened to her husband, who just disappeared in the middle of the night, now she heard what happened to him and how he died cruelly, sadistically. She jumped over the barrier which was supposed to protect, you know, the witnesses from the victims' families, dodged around the police officers and went straight towards the murderer of the man she'd chosen in this life, the father of her children. And all she did was put her big black arms around this white South African, hug him and said, "I forgive you." And in that, when I read that, I got emotional. I've said this story so many times, I get emotional now. If a woman can forgive the murderer of her husband, extrajudicial, torture, huge pain, first time, and she loved this man, she said, "I forgive," because that was the only way forward. The only way. I say these things because if she could forgive the murderer of her husband, the father of her children, why can't we forgive other people? Have you done that bad? It's always less, but we somehow or other we think it's wrong to forgive. First of all, it's the best possible course of action. Everybody benefits when we forgive. We don't do the same thing again when we forgive. In fact, if we don't forgive, we carry it around, then we're more likely to misbehave and create more pain in this world. Psychologists will probably quote research papers on that. But it's beneficial to forgive and to learn. And the next thing to know is each one of you have the choice. No one can forgive you. You might go to a church, you may go to a temple, you may bow down three times with flowers, candles and incense, whatever. That's a lot of, again, bullshit, waste of time. The only one who can forgive you is yourself. It has to come from inside. You have that choice. You can do it. Other people have done it. It's incredible what happens when you forgive yourself. And once you've done that, there's this great sense of freedom, and learning starts from that point once you've forgiven. You learn not to do it again. So it's a powerful, powerful thing, forgiveness. I've seen it many, many times. It's growth. And people become free. Okay, on this is, no, okay, cacao, no, I can go on forever on this. Carry on.
It sounds like like the gentle qualities of Buddhism, like forgiveness and power to them, but I think a lot of people in the West feel that they can be soft, and if we want to pursue a serious career in banking or, you know, or even in any career these days, academic, that we have to be hard and even ruthless at times in order to achieve great heights. So what, and some people might succeed in that way. So what are your thoughts? Do we have to be a little bit hard at times in order to be, to really get to the pinnacle of success?
For a long time ago when I was growing up, I thought you had to be rich to be successful. And then people came along and said, no, no, no. You need happiness, first of all, to achieve success. You have to find a career which you're passionate about, you really enjoy, and if you really enjoy it, it's who you are, you really love it, then you'll be successful. They said that happiness is a cause, it leads to success. So find a career, find a path in your life which you really are passionate, you enjoy, and then you'll be successful. And I realized that was bullshit too. Happiness is success. It doesn't lead to success. Once you're happiness, if you are passionate about what you're doing, right now you're successful. That's what success is. So we should redefine what success is. Success is being happy. You know, just being with your kids and just playing with them. Are you happy? You're now a successful mum. So happiness is success. So, it doesn't matter if you're a banker or a monk, it doesn't matter if you're a parking inspector or what you do. If you are happy, well done, you're now successful. You've made it. Changing the idea of happiness. But, you know, we do need bankers. You know, we do need politicians and stuff. You know, but sort of do it well. There's a lot of people which I've met, you know, in high positions of power. And, you know, sometimes they complain that the system makes them lie. The system just keeps blocking them from changing stuff. So I think the positions of power, like the banking industry or politics, I think it's a systematic error, not human error. And there's all sorts of incredible ways to change it. For example, democracy. It's not really democratic. Now, even our system, as you all know. So what I want to suggest, crazy idea, but who knows? Crazy ideas can sometimes happen. If you are, say, running a company, the more money you've invested in that company, the more votes you have. You know, the more shares you have, the more votes you have in the annual general meeting. That's fair enough. You've got so much investment there, you should have more say. Life. An 80-year-old hasn't got many more shares left in this world, but say a 20-year-old has got their whole life in front of them. So I reckon, say a 20-year-old should maybe have the full vote, 40-year-old maybe about 70% of the vote, 50-year-old maybe half, 70-year-old maybe 10%, they're going to be out of here soon. Because if a 70-year-old no votes on climate change, what the hell, I'm not going to be here when it happens. But the 20-year-olds, you're going to have to face the consequences of climate change. Not Mr. Turnbull. So this is one of the reasons why I reckon that we should actually weight the vote towards the young. They've got more shares in life. And to give far, far greater weight of democratic votes, because you've got more investment in this world than, say, I have. I'm 64 now. So you should have, how old are you? Come on, admit it.
31.
So, okay, so you should have many more votes than I have.
My one concern, though, I researched successful aging, and it feels like wisdom can come with age. So shouldn't we have people more like you who have the wisdom of age who have more weight than 20-year-olds who basically don't know that much?
Well, if you have me as wisdom of aging, I would say give the vote to the 20s. So you can't have it both ways. If you think I'm wise, then follow what I say.
Can I ask something about humour? Because you have a great sense of humour, and I think that that brings such a lightheartedness. But what about poor people who don't have, even I don't feel like I really have much of a sense of humour, and I'm sure others might feel the same. So what about those of us in the room that don't have a sense of humour? How can we find that?
Oh, after a while, I'll wear you down. You're laughing right now. Because humour is just acknowledging the human situation. I don't know if humanity or human and humour, they start off with the same three letters, whether they've got some etymological, some derivation connection there. You know, to be human is to laugh. Because something I've noticed, I've been around 64 years now, sort of everybody laughs. The only people to laugh, that have laughter, love, and being alive. They seem to have very common roots. You know, to actually to love is to laugh together. How many of you, you know, you have a wonderful time with a lover because you have so much fun together, you laugh together. And if you have a relationship with hardly any laughter, the love vanishes and dies. Laughter, fun, joy is such an important part of a relationship. And so laughter and love, they go together. And so does life as well, because I've noticed if you're alive, you laugh. The only people I've ever seen who don't laugh are the ones in the coffins, the dead people. They're the only ones I've ever seen who don't laugh. That's actually, you know, if they're alive or they're dead. You tickle them or tell them a joke. So to be alive is to laugh, and to laugh at life. Don't take yourself so seriously.
What about achieving goals? A lot of people have big goals for their life, and that requires a lot of determination, which is not very lighthearted, I guess.
Yeah, no, they've got the wrong goals. Well, even laughter, you can achieve so many, many, many goals, you know, when you're laughing. Now, obviously, health. Look, you may see me here, and many people, they get it totally wrong. They think that I'm fat. Now, I'm going to correct that misconception at the very beginning of this tour of Melbourne. This is not fat. Now, I've been a monk for 42 years now.
Oh.
Every year you're a monk, you actually grow in compassion. You see, that's our training. So every year as a monk, your heart gets a little bit bigger. My heart now is so big after 42 years of growth. It can't push my rib cage out anymore, so it's pushing down and out here. This is not fat. This is a big heart. I got you laughing. Yes, I got it. Yeah. Anyway. And the other thing is, have you ever noticed that fat people, you know, for the most part, are very happy people. They're jolly. And this was something which I really wondered about, because, you know, if you are fat, you've got more sort of cholesterol and other gut going through your blood vessels. So, you know, how come that, you know, have all these fat, happy people? And I found out from somebody gave me this article on Science that when you are angry, depressed, stressed out, your blood vessels contract, they get smaller. But when you're laugh and happy, your blood vessels actually expand, they get bigger. Now, I've been laughing for such a long time that my blood vessels are so wide that I can eat anything and they never have a traffic jam in there. There is no strokes or heart attacks because it's so wide. And that explains a lot. That's why the happy fat people are still alive. The miserable fat people died a long time ago. Examples. One of the fattest, happiest spiritual people. And he was old when I was a kid. And he's still alive today.
Wow.
Father Christmas. He's fat and he's always happy. Ho, ho, ho. And he's still alive. Okay, if this was a medical school, I'd be thrown out probably.
What draws so many people to Buddhism is that whenever we do research, Buddhism seems to always win. It seems to be backed by science. But there is one exception, and that is rebirth. So why is it that Buddhism believes in rebirth when to date it hasn't been backed by science?
It is because if you ever did see that TED talk by, was it Rupert Sheldrake? If you haven't seen it, it's a couple of years old now. But Professor Rupert Sheldrake, he's got all of the professor of, I think, biophysics or something from Cambridge University, that he went on TED Channel and his subject was that science is dogmatic. And he made this great distinction between scientific method and scientific dogma. And if there's any scientists here, one thing he said resonated with me, because I first heard this from the predecessor of Stephen Hawking, who's Professor Fred Hoyle. He was, when I was at Cambridge, the Lucasian Professor of Physics, a brilliant guy. And I went to one of his lectures, and spellbinding. And one of the things he said there was repeated by Rupert Sheldrake. Sheldrake actually gave the evidence to it. This is ordinary high school physics, so you don't need to know too much about it. The Newtonian gravitation. The attraction between two massive bodies is equal to the multiplication of their masses divided by the square of their distance apart, multiplied by the universal gravitational constant, big G, which is supposed to be a constant. And Fred Hoyle suggests, why does it have to be a constant? This professor in Cambridge was questioning everything, which is what a scientist should do. You shouldn't have any dogma. Anything is up for questioning. And lo and behold, Rupert Sheldrake went around many government-funded laboratories, even CSIRO here in Australia, because scientists are employed by the government to measure these quantities every few years to find out if they are constant. And with the case of big G, it has been changing significantly, much greater than experimental error. Something is going on there, which is undermining one of the basic structures of physics, which many of the other scientific disciplines are based on. And he goes and blows a whistle and said, look, this is changing. It's not a constant. And you teach that in schools. And what happened? He was the only talk on TED Channel which got taken off, got banned. And as soon as it got banned, he went on social media and said, there we go, proved it, you're dogmatic. And so they had to put him back on again. And he makes a very good, the scientific method, if there's any scientists here, for goodness sake, challenge everything. Unfortunately, your professors will not agree with you. There was, again, you're getting on a passionate subject over here on science. There was Brian Josephson. I mention him because he's a meditator. Got a Nobel Prize. Because his great discovery, he was still an undergraduate when he did the math for this, was how basically you can get the same as silicon junctions at absolute zero, called the Josephson junction. It what powers supercomputers. And when he said this in solid state physics, there was another guy who had, I think, the only person ever to get three Nobel Prizes. And this other professor with three Nobel Prizes said, no, that's a lot of rubbish. You're only an undergraduate, for goodness sake. You are wrong. And it took Brian Josephson about 5 or 6 years of argument and eventually experiment to prove that he was right and the triple Nobel laureate was wrong. That was typical of the dogmatism in science. So sometimes, instead of everything being on the table to be rediscovered, there's far too much dogmatism in science. And one of those is the nature of the human mind. everybody, in especially Roger Penrose. I met him once. He was the guy who found black holes. Because I was still connected with physics, when he came through Perth, I got invited to dinner with him. I never ate anything because I'm a monk, but I'm a good monk. And this is the fellow who discovered black holes, okay? One of the best physicists in the world. And trying to get a conversation with him, you might as well be talking to a sort of a brick wall. Socially, he's got no skills at all. He's just brilliant at science, but stupid, really stupid at life. So, no, this guy, he was trying to say, no, it's mitochondriae. That is where the sense of mind and consciousness comes from. And that is, again, so wrong. Even in physics, I know my physics, okay? People quote quantum physics, they don't know what they're talking about, but I know my stuff. And it does show there, you cannot have reality without an observer, without a mind. It's Schrodinger's equation. Physics, which is hard physics, shows that the mind has to be independent. And if you want an argument, a simple argument, which even kids can understand, which no one has ever managed to confute and tell me where it's wrong, the nature of the mind, is this. Simple argument, come again from one of my friends. His daughter, grade one at school in UK, teacher asked the question, what is the biggest thing in the world? My daddy, said a five-year-old. No, an elephant, they've just been to the zoo. No, a mountain is the biggest thing in the world. The daughter of my friend from college, who graduated PhD, she was doing research in Oxford in biophysics or chemistry or something, brilliant girl, 5 years of age, she said, my eye is the biggest thing in the world. Yes. I said, what do you mean, your eye? She said, because my eye can see her daddy, my eye can see a mountain, an elephant, and so much more. If all of that can fit into my eye, my eye must be the biggest thing in the world. That's pretty amazing. Logic and reason. And that's valid. I said, but no, this, you can go further than that. Because your mind can see everything your eye can see. And your mind can imagine things your eye will never see. And your mind can hear sounds, real and imaginary. It can smell, taste, it can feel. It's also got its own area of knowing. And in fact, everything which can ever be known in this universe can all fit into the mind. So the mind is the biggest thing. Not the biggest thing in the world. The world can be known. So the world fits into your mind. When you look at that framework, that is far more accurate than thinking this mind is some emanation of the human brain. So science, this is again going back to my professor Bernard Carr, he knows these things, but he was saying he's only recently retired, so he's now emeritus professor at Queen Mary College in London University of theoretical physics. Again, close student of Stephen Hawking's. And he said, only now am I going to go out there and I'm going to actually tell what I know about from Buddhism about the nature of the mind. He said, this is for the next years of my life, this is my goal, my quest, to actually to knock some mind sense into modern science. When it comes to reincarnation, the facts are there. As one professor from the United States said, if, say Lydia, if you suddenly disappeared and appeared in the back of this room, we couldn't deny that evidence. That happened. And we couldn't say it didn't happen because we couldn't really find out how that actually worked. How could you come from here and just appear in the other part of the room? That's not the point. We all saw it. It happened. We know that there are people who can remember their past lives accurately, and there's no other explanation for the knowledge which they have got except they were that person. Not one, hundreds of well-researched cases of people who recall their past lives, who have been examined in the most rigorous ways. No way could this be a fraud. Hundreds of them, probably even more than that. But will science even look at the evidence? No. Why? Because it can't happen. Another little example for you. We call it the flower pot experiment. It was done in the Imperial College in London some years ago. And Professor Bernard Carr was telling me about this. An experimenter, he announced he was going to demonstrate levitation of a flower pot in front of his colleagues, which were professors, later on, professors, otherwise I'll levitate you out of the room. Professors and really hard scientists. He said, I'm going to demonstrate levitation. So, you know, in this science lab, he had, you know, the table there. He brought in a flower pot. You know, everyone could feel it. No strings attached, nothing, you know, funny there. A real flower pot with a flower in it. Put it on the table. And then he said, in front of everyone, you can get your cameras out. It was all videoed. You can watch it if you wish on your smartphones. We're now going to levitate this flower pot, which is impossible, obviously. And he said, to get the right atmosphere, which I need, I want you all to chant Om. And it's amazing that these hard-nosed physicists in England were all chanting Om, Om, Om. And as they were chanting Om, the flower pot rose into the air. Wow. It worked. It levitated. And it was incredible. This was caught on camera. It happened. Now, do you believe that?
Nope.
Yes.
Stand up.
But maybe you didn't see it, so you know. But there were people there who were there and they saw it. And several of those people, even though they saw it and it was videoed, they say it didn't happen. It didn't happen. It was stayed on the table all the time. Just to let you know what really happened, underneath that table there's a huge electromagnet.
Yes!
And the reason why they had to chant Om is because when you turn the current on in such a large magnet, there's always a hum. And the Om was to mask the humming. But that wasn't the point of the experiment. The point of the experiment was on perception and how several of those scientists, they denied that the thing even rose in the air because it went so contrary to their worldview. It can't happen. Therefore it didn't. Unfortunately, that's with science. Because much of science is dogmatic, only certain things can happen. And if something which is so outside of our worldview actually occurs right in front of us, denial is so strong that they can't even see it. And that was an amazing part of that experiment in front of these were researchers, trained observers, people who spent their whole life observing instruments, phenomena in laboratories. And because it went against, you know, what they believed was possible, they just did not see it. Be careful. The evidence is there.
I've been the president of this Buddhist Society for 5 years now, and every teacher pretty much that I've invited has been a man. And that's not because I like men more than women, but it just seems like
weird.
A lot of the teachers in Buddhism tend to be male. So why do men have so much power in Buddhism?
It is because of a perversion of the old tradition. If you go back to early Buddhism, there were many enlightened nuns, teachers. It does seem to be the majority were male, but there was a significant 30% of the teachers were women, highly enlightened nuns with psychic powers, the works. In the time of the Buddha, there was equity. That has disappeared. In Mahayana tradition, you've kept it. Well done, Chinese, Taiwanese. The Tibetan tradition and the Theravada tradition dropped it. But in Australia, it's come back again. You know my story. In 2009, again, it's not the case we complain about these but I'm a Western trained. I can't be a Buddhist and just, you know, take, you know, inequity when it happens. I will stand up for people. And I don't care against who. I said last night in a talk in Perth, His Holiness the Dalai Lama was recorded as writing, cited in an article in the Daily Telegraph in UK that you cannot be gay and be a Buddhist. That's what he said. And when I saw that, because I've got many friends, Buddhists, who are gay, and they were devastated. Imagine, you know, you're saying you can't be a woman and be a Buddhist. I mean, that's ridiculous. So I wrote an article to the paper and said, His Holiness the Dalai Lama is a really good man and very wise and inspiring, but we all get it wrong sometime. He's wrong there. You can be, you are welcome. I stood up for the gays. And I got hate mail from some Tibetan teachers. But I don't mind, I'll stand up. But I said last night, as a result of me standing up, Buddhists, welcome, gays, lesbians, transgenders, you are welcome as equal members of humanity, obviously. But anyway, that's as a reward for that, and one of the things I'm very proud of, one of the things which I remember as one of the great accolades which I received, was to get my invitation to the gay and lesbian Mardi Gras breakfast. I was so honoured. So I stood up for them. I still managed to stand. And of course, standing up for women, 2009, you know, we had women who wanted to become nuns. Full nuns, bhikkhunis, not sort of second rate, second class nuns. So we did it. I arranged and did the ceremonies for the first ordination of Buddhist women in the Theravada Thai tradition. And I got expelled from the monastery where I grew up. Again, that's another great accolade, which I'll take. And I don't know, it's sometimes you ever wanted to be like a rebel and be expelled. It's one of those things on my bucket list, and I've ticked that one off. But you've done something. You stood up. Okay, you take the flak. So any of you, as a Buddhist, don't ever be afraid. And if there's something which needs to be done, you stand up and get it done, because if you don't, you'll regret it for your whole life. You had a chance to change and do something for others. You never took that opportunity. So yes, we do have fully ordained nuns now. They are growing up. They are being developed. I call my monastery a monk factory. We now have a nun factory, a couple going. So they're almost ready. So next time you invite them.
And I know there's the Satyadita International Society that promotes women in Buddhism. Have you ever been to a Satyadita?
Yes, the last one. I gave one of the keynote addresses over there, over in Yogyakarta. So yeah, I get involved in this. I get into trouble, but, you know, trouble is my middle name. Ajahn Trouble Brother. Have you ever noticed that's what religious leaders are supposed to do? You know, we're supposed to give moral leadership by example, not just preaching about it. Because that's one of the reasons why in places like the West, people turn away from religion. What's the point? You know, they're not doing anything. There is some problems in our society, and there are really strong moral inequities, and our leaders are not speaking out against it. They're not doing anything about it. That is actually a lack of moral leadership, lack of moral backbone, and that's unacceptable. So you know, we should do things.
And I've got one final question before we open it to a couple of audience questions. But I'd like to ask you that spiritual or personal growth in the modern world, if there was one secret to personal growth, or you could call it spiritual growth, how we can sort of reach our highest potential, what would that one secret be?
It is the story about don't just think about it, do it. It was a time when, it was a training which you had as a young monk. We had to do physical labour in Thailand, and this one occasion is a big pile of earth which was left over from building a hall, and so monks like me had to move it with wheelbarrows and shovels. You only had one meal a day in those days, and I was really, really thin and weak because it was terrible, terrible food. I've told stories about the disgusting food we used to have in those days, frogs and snails and anything which crawled we ate. It was yucky too. And anyway, so really undernourished. And after our one meal a day, finished about 9 o'clock, we had to shovel earth and move it in wheelbarrows to the right place for 3 days in the hot jungles, bitten by mosquitoes, malnourished and really dirty. But you know, I had faith. After 3 days, we'd finished. And that night, Ajahn Chah went off to another monastery. And the second monk brought all the monks together and said, I've been thinking that we've moved it into the wrong place. So we had to move it again. 3 days of hard work, being bitten by mosquitoes, tired, malnourished, and oh, it's terrible. But we finished it 6 days. I thought, oh, great. Now tomorrow I can meditate, have a relaxing time, wash my clothes. I was stinky. And that night, Ajahn Chah, the teacher, came back. And he said to us after our one meal of the day, I thought I told you to put it over there. You put it over here. Move it. And that was a time I lost my faith. These monks, the bosses, they never do any work. It's monks like me had to do it. And so I was really upset, really angry, swearing.
Oh.
In English, so the Thai monks couldn't understand me. But they could. And one of these monks, they came up to me, they saw I was suffering. And what they gave to me was just worth those 9 days of hard work. He said, pushing a wheelbarrow is easy. Thinking about it is hard. And that's the whole life. Whatever you're doing in life, whether it's going for a cancer operation, thinking about it is a hard part. Doing it is easy. Doing an examination in this university, getting an assignment finished in time. Doing it is easy. Thinking about it is the hard part. In your whole life, doing life is such a simple thing. Thinking about it is the hard part. Once you understand that, for goodness sake, learn how to don't think so much and do more. Okay? Spirituality, simple stuff, but changes your whole life. All the problems you have to face in life, you become a boss, you have to tell somebody off because they're not performing well. Don't think about it. You'll lose sleep about it. Just go and do it. That's even like dying. Don't think about it, just do it.
Great. Well, thank you very much. When thinking about it, I'll just do it. Remember that. It's a bit hard for us to move microphones around, but for the
last... I got one there. Yeah.
We've got one there.
And one there.
So we might have to pass it, and we've got one there. So we've got time for a couple of questions. So you've got the microphone. Do you have a question?
Yes, I do actually. Ajahn Brahm, how do you let go and not get attached to your goals and desires?
Oh, because my goal is to let go. It's easy then. Okay, look. I've been telling this story for a long time, and I've seen this, somebody showed me like a YouTube video. There's some sort of psychologist somewhere has been putting this on here. It's just taking what I've been teaching for years. How do you let go? You've got your goals, desires, all the stuff you have to do. How heavy is a glass of water? You've seen me do this before. The longer you hold it, the heavier it feels. After 5 minutes, it's so heavy you're in pain and you're stupid. What do you do when it starts getting to be too heavy to hold comfortably?
Let go.
Put it down, yeah. And you don't need to throw it away. You just put it down and rest for a while. And after a few seconds, you can pick it up again and actually it does feel lighter. This is the stress of life. The reason why people get stressed out and become unproductive and unsuccessful is because, yeah, you get tired doing your assignment or, you know, doing the little job for your company. You don't know how to take a break. You keep pushing. Have you ever been in front of that computer screen and you just not productive at all. You can't think of the words, you can't make a sentence, you're just wasting your time. But you keep pushing. You are a time waster. Instead, you should turn the machine off and go meditate, relax, let go. Half an hour, quarter of an hour, however long it takes, when you go back to that screen, now you are productive. The half an hour of meditation is called an investment in time. You make it up afterwards. You get 3 hours work done in two of high quality when you know how to let go. So the meditation, the letting go, this training to relax the mind actually makes you far more productive, greater efficiency, and more successful. Look how successful a monk I am. I know how to let go because I know it makes me be able to work harder afterwards. Easy.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Ajahn Brahm. Actually, I have two subsequent questions. The first one is, the monks have a responsibility to explain the Buddhist scriptures to the common people, lay people like us.
Yeah, you're not common.
the lay people like us.
Yeah.
So they come and they chant and they explain the Buddhist scriptures and Buddha's verses and teachings. How can we be really sure that the explanations that we are getting right at this time of point of time or age, those explanations and interpretations are correctly done? Because monks, there are thousands, millions of monks
yeah.
in the entire world. And in relation to this issue, as you said that you are, definitely I should thank you that you are welcoming the nuns. In my country, actually, there have been a severe conflict between two groups of monks, whether to welcome the nuns or not. And a group of the monks are explaining that actually the Buddhist scripture says that Buddha did not allow the nuns. At the same time, the other one is saying that yes, there is scope to welcome the nuns into the community. So how do you actually, how do we solve this paradox?
It's very easy, as I said before, don't think about it, just do it. Which is the wonderful thing. So there'll always be, when you get to, it's like lawyers. Some of these monks are not really monks, they're more like lawyers. Missing the whole point that these Buddhist scriptures, you know, they are coming from the heart, not from the head. Unfortunately, that too many monastic systems have actually gone to too much, excuse me, in the university, too much scholarships and not enough actually practice, which actually destroyed like the Anglican tradition. And just too many university graduates were going to be vicars and they were just as boring as hell. They had no idea what was going on in real life. Yeah, they could know Latin and Greek, but you know, what's that to do with someone who's going through a divorce? So it's really important to look at any scriptures just like Lonely Planet Guide to Enlightenment. So if you get a Lonely Planet Guide, you know, you've got to go there first of all to check it out whether, you know, what they say in there is true or not. And it's a waste of time, monks, you know, to actually starting to talk about these things when they don't know what they're doing. They've never been. I can write a book about Paris. But actually, it's one city I've never been to. So what do I know about Paris? Same with a person, they can explain and write books about these places. You haven't been there. You haven't smelt the place, felt it. Being inside of it, then you don't really know it. So that's one of the reasons why scholarship is great, but the practice is more important. Great simile from Ajahn Chah. He said, it's just like your main course and your dessert, your sweet afterwards. So, you know, are you Thai? Where are you from, sir?
I'm from Bangladesh.
From Bangladesh, okay. In Bangladesh, curry and rice, you know, maybe some fruit or some sweets afterwards. And so, he said, just doing studies is like just eating the sweets. No rice and curry. Which means you get sick after a while. So he said, what you should be doing is rice and curry first, the main course. That's the practice of your life. And the sweets are the study afterwards. Otherwise, you just get lopsided and sick. And that's one of the reasons why. But in the end, you know, it's just, we just do it. And there'll always be people who argue it shouldn't be done. But really, the people who own Buddhism, the people who own Christianity, is not the cardinals and the popes and the bishops. It's the people, the ordinary people, you know, who go to the church every week. In Bangladesh, the people who own Buddhism in Bangladesh are just the ordinary Buddhists. If they support the bhikkhunis, the nuns, then that's game over. They're there. And the monks would eventually come, as they say, dragged, crying and screaming. Yeah, we supported them all the time, they would say. But it's actually for you guys. You have the power. Exert that power. So support the nuns. Support the gays. Support lesbians, transgenders. And then the other people in power will actually be coming with you. So that is the way it works. And if you want to know who knows the scriptures or not, you know, who knows Buddhism, look for their behavior, their actions. Because that tells much more about their spiritual development, you know, than their knowledge of Pali. Okay. Next one. There's lots of people. You got this. Okay, can up the top, because otherwise it just comes down to the front here. Please go up to the top and make the microphone go to the back a bit more, please. Yes.
Mahayana in Tibetan Buddhism says it's most important to find the right teacher before becoming a monk. What does Theravada say?
I say it's the same as in a university. If you're in this university, how many teachers do you have? If you're not in this university, you may have been to university. In a university, you have many teachers. Because some teachers are strong in one area and weak in other areas. Same as me, that in some areas I'm really strong and weak in other areas. And so it's great to have many teachers. Which is one of the reasons why in all traditions, this is straight down the line Buddhism, we go to refuge in what's called the Triple Gem, the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. We don't go to refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and Ajahn Brahm. We don't go to refuge the Buddha, the Dhamma, and Rinpoche this. We don't go to refuge the Buddha, the Dhamma, and Master somebody else. That's a very important point, because sometimes the Master, the Guru, is given a place which was never really expected to be taken in early Buddhism. In the end, of course, the teacher has to be yourself, the teacher within. As even the Buddha said, Buddhas only show the way. It's up to you to explore that way and find out if it's the right one for you. So please be careful of the guru trap. So who's the next? Who's got the microphones? Oh, yeah, up the top there, yeah.
Thank you for your wonderful talk. You spoke about forgiveness.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering, what do you do when the mind goes to, like, it's hard for you to forgive someone because you think, well, if you forgive them, they'll think that they haven't done anything wrong. It could be quite a strong thing. So I understand that that's not right thinking, but how do you be able to approve that?
Okay. Well, in all the times I've been visiting prisons, I've never found one person in a jail who doesn't know they've done something wrong. And I've talked with other people who've been in prison a long time. A lot of time they don't admit that to other people. They put on the face, the bravado, that, you know, I haven't done anything wrong, it's a system. But if you actually talk to them and they trust you, as you know, they managed to do with myself, and so they can open up to you. And they always say the same thing, they just wish they hadn't have done this, why they did this, they feel so sorry about it. They may not say that to their victim, because they feel afraid of being honest, but they do feel that. So I'm a great believer, not just in theory, but with my life, that people do have a conscience. They do feel that guilt. And so for you to forgive them, that's huge for those people. They've imagined, how can she forgive me? She must see something in me which I haven't seen in myself. Something which is worth forgiving. And that is the start of their rehabilitation. Every time I've been to a jail and seen some terrible criminals, they've done gross crimes, sees something inside of them which they can respect. The old two bad bricks in the wall simile. You see the other good bricks in the wall. Once you see those other good bricks in the wall, that's when you don't need to destroy the wall again anymore. So it's a great thing if you can do that, and that's a huge gift for them, and it's a huge gift of freedom for yourself. Okay. Hi.
Hi. So I just wanted to ask a question about chronic illness.
Yes.
Yes. So I've been suffering Lyme disease for 3 years.
Okay, very good.
And I guess I just wanted to hear about your advice on how to, you know, utilize Buddhist teaching, Buddhist practice to help cope with chronic illness, not as a cure, like you say.
Good. But please don't try and cure yourself. Care for yourself. That's something you can always do. And for goodness sake, please, people don't ever stigmatize people who are physically, emotionally, or any otherwise disabled. Because there's no such thing really as a disabled person. There's a person, part of whom has a disability. You're much more than your Lyme disease. You're huge. Lyme disease is only a small part of you. Please never forget that. This great story, I've been talking about this a long time, and I gave a keynote address at some 50th or 60th anniversary of the Institute of Mental Health in Singapore. At the end of the talk, one of the people in the audience said he was a professor of schizophrenia in Institute of Mental Health in Singapore. And he wanted me to go and bless his ward, even though he's a Catholic. And I said, well, what did you like about my talk? And he said, well, exactly what you're saying about, you know, you're much more than Lyme disease. And I said, how do you treat schizophrenia in Singapore? He said, I don't treat schizophrenia. And that was just a shock. He was a professor of schizophrenia in the one shop stop for mental illness, you know, in Singapore. Professor of schizophrenia, he doesn't treat schizophrenia. He said, what do you do? Because I sussed him out, you're always going to say. He said, exactly as you've just been teaching, Ajahn Brahm, I don't treat schizophrenia in the schizophrenia ward of Singapore Institute of Mental Health. I treat the other part of the patient. Wow. Now that is somebody who is a scientist, who sees far more than other people have. And of course, I had to ask him, what are your results? Way, way better than conventional treatment. There's no such thing as a schizophrenic. There's a person, a huge being in there, who has episodes of schizophrenia. Please focus on some of the other parts of them. Stop stigmatizing them. Stop treating them as a victim. You're huge.
Yeah.
Good day.
I was reading an article a few weeks ago about the importance of what the Buddha stressed about right view and two qualities that was emphasized, which were a deep attention and spiritual kinship or friendship. And I just wanted you to just elaborate on the spiritual kinship, friendship side of things, and reflect on your experience with that, how much of a important element of that played in your role of being a monk, but in life in general?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. And one of my books is amazing. It got to number 3 in Germany this year. And of all books, romances, sci-fis, everything, I was number 3 in the bestseller list there. And it was, the title of it was The Elephant Who Lost Its Happiness. And the story was of an elephant who was, you know, king's elephant. Elephants were like the Rolls Royces, the limos of kings in the old days. And so this was a really, really good elephant, but in the space of a few days it turned out to being really badly behaved. You know, would squirt water at the king. It would sort of poop just when the trainer was right behind him. And if you've ever seen an elephant poop, that's a lot of poop. So, and the king didn't know why he'd suddenly changed from being a really well-behaved elephant to being really nasty. So he got the vet in, and the vet couldn't find anything physically wrong with him, and so they had this minister, this wise minister, said, I'll look after this. And so he sat meditation all night, you know, next to the elephant stall, and early in the morning he was disturbed. There were sounds of people behind the elephant stall. He investigated, and there was a group of thieves. And they were meeting there every evening to actually decide who they're going to rob, who they're going to beat up for not paying their debts. Really a lot of bad people. And he understood where the elephant had lost his happiness. He had all those thieves arrested, and he replaced those thieves with monks, meditating, chanting, talking about good stuff. Because he realized that even elephants who cannot understand, you know, human language, they can pick up on the vibes of bad people. And by osmosis, if you're around bad people, you actually become a bad person. If you're around good people, you just automatically become a good person. You can't resist it. That's what spiritual friendship is all about. So that's one of the reasons why, you know, you tell people, look, you've got like a husband who's really misbehaving, as a pain in the neck. Send him to a monastery like mine. Hanging around good monks and good people, after a while, you know, he will change. He'll come back to Melbourne and just new improved model. The trouble is that he changes because he osmosis is from us, but we osmosis from him and we become worse. But that's like spiritual friendship. It does uplift you to be around good people. So hang out with good people. That's a choice which you can make.
Maybe one final question.
Oh.
Hi Arjun. I've been reading a lot about mindfulness.
Yeah.
And it feels like in the last couple of decades it's been kind of rebranded and kind of stripped of all of the kind of Buddhism and the mysticism to make it kind of more palatable to a Western audience, for want of a better word, and especially for treatment of chronic disease and stuff like that. And there are some, you know, a little bit of outrage saying that, you know, you could murder someone mindfully. I was wondering if you had any thoughts about that.
Yeah, it's... Well, you may all know the mindfulness movement, you will know this, started from Jon Kabat-Zinn. And just 2 years ago, I was in Nova Scotia in Halifax, which is ahead of Shambhala, which is publishing a lot of his works. And you know, they gave me the info that Kabat-Zinn, who is a practicing Buddhist, was really upset that, you know, he'd taken the Buddhism away from mindfulness to make it acceptable to a place like United States, which is so Christian. Any hints of Buddhism, it would mean that whatever merit there was in his research and practices would not be accepted. So in order to get it out there, to help people, he sort of took away the Buddhism aspect of it, angle of it, stripped it of that so it could be accepted. But he feels very guilty about that now. And so he was trying, actually, whatever he could to put the Buddhism back into mindfulness. And of course, you know, you would know there has been some very negative findings in some people. Just doing mindfulness alone, there's been some very negative occurrences. You know, there's a journalist from The Guardian in UK went to a mindfulness course. She had to because it was obligatory because of her company. And she had such a great panic attack, she went into psychosis and she was in an institution for 6 months because of doing mindfulness meditation. Obviously, you know, there's an exception, there's a rarity, but there are some dangers there. And if it was, you know, someone who's like a monk like me, you could see what's going on straight away. You have all these other sort of tools in your workshop, not just the saw of mindfulness, which you can actually bring in to help out. So sometimes you're working with most people, it's okay, mindfulness, but you're working with some people with some deep psychoses, traumas, anxiety disorders, depressions, and a lot of times it's just a blunt instrument and it can sometimes cause harm. Whereas a full workshop, you know, is much safer. And the one thing which I have been going out there and pushing and pushing and pushing is actually just adding just one little extra ingredient. There's many more ingredients to mindfulness, but the most important one is kindness, which is why, you know, it's a nice buzzword. I coined the word kindfulness. And just changing the first letter from mindfulness to kindfulness, again, it changes the ball game. And it just means that when you are doing any mindfulness therapies, the kindness is in there, the caring, not curing, the compassion, and that is incredibly powerful. So I'm trying my bit to mindfulness is great, but it's move it forward, develop it, take it to the next step, for goodness sake. Otherwise, it will just fall away again. It has great benefits, but more can be done. So don't just be mindful, be kind.
Be kindful.
So I think that's a great question to end the night. It's a bit sad to end the night though, because it feels like I'm hypnotized with so much loving kindness and humour. and perhaps some of you feel like this as well. It's such a pleasure to hear you talk, Ajahn Brahm. So I think on behalf of everybody here tonight and on behalf of the Melbourne University Buddhist Society and also the Buddhist Society of Victoria, we'd like to thank you very much for all your energy and
very good.
Time here tonight.
Hi, Anbeck. Hi. Oh, honey, I can come. Goodbye.